You are tuned in to Copyright Chat. Copyright Chat is a podcast dedicated to discussing important copyright matters. Host Sarah Benson, the copyright librarian from the University of Illinois, converses with experts from across the globe to engage the public with rights issues relevant to their daily lives. All right, welcome to another episode of Copyright Chat. Today, I have Winston Tabb joining me from Johns Hopkins University. He's a university librarian and a longtime expert advisor to the Copyright and Other Legal Matters Committee of the IFLA organization. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's so nice to see you and to see you on the verge, I understand, of your retirement.
Yes, I think it's going to happen sometime. I just don't know exactly when because I had agreed to stay on until my successor was in place. So the process is moving along. I hear by rumors. The day will come.
Well, congratulations. And I know throughout your career, you've had a lot of interest and expertise with international copyright issues, both with the Copyright and Other Legal Matters Committee and with the World Intellectual Property Organization. And I wanted to take this opportunity to kind of pick your brain about that process of how we the United States and IFLA engage with the World Intellectual Property Organization. It, from what I've heard, it seems to move pretty slowly, and it's a very political process, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the first things to understand is what an unusual organization the World Intellectual Property Organization is. And within it, there is a particular subgroup, the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights, which is the one with which we engage. I don't remember exactly how many branches there are of WIPO, but that's the most important one for us. What I couldn't believe when I went to my first meeting, and it still amazes me, is that you can have an organization with, I think, 185 or so member states, and they come and they go, that functions entirely by consensus. That is, there is never a vote taken in the sense that you would have a normal body where 51% of the people would be able to prevail if it came to that. So any one country, whether it's Russia or Ukraine, the largest country or the smallest country, can really bring things to a halt. And that's why it is so frustrating sometimes, because the progress is so glacial. On the other hand, when you do have a victory in an environment like this, it's really a major. So the most important thing that has happened, I believe, in the 20 or so years that I've been engaged there is the adoption of the Marrakesh Treaty, which almost didn't happen and took quite a long time, several false starts and starting over. But part of the reason that so little happens in actual fact is because of this necessity for having consensus.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think most people in the world are, I guess maybe not most, but many are aware of that treaty. And it seemed like a pretty smooth process from the outside. But can you give us kind of an insider's view a little bit of how long this was pending and kind of what happened with the treaty?
Yeah, well, as I said, there were several false starts. So I went to WIPO for the first time in 2003, which is the time when I was appointed to be the chair of IFLA's Copyright Committee. Of course, I was just kind of amazed at how things worked and how they didn't. And my very first meeting that I went to was of the Cultural Administration Group. I think you're going to be working with them, if I understand right. They're working on some kind of an instrument that would deal with the cultures. And I was so fascinated to see that sitting at the table were people from various minority groups. So the Sami from the north, the Maori from New Zealand were actually part of the official groups. And it was a very substantive discussion. And so I was kind of expecting it was going to be like that when I went to other meetings, such as to the meeting of the Standing Committee on Copyright. Well, it's definitely not the case. The Standing Committee on Copyright is members of federal agencies only. The United States usually has people there, led always by the Patent and Trademark Office, because they're in the executive branch, but also generally at least one person from the U.S. Copyright Office. So, but I really was kind of amazed when we first started working on what came to be the Marrakesh Treaty to find that there had been a lot of efforts in the early 90s to have such a treaty, and they finally just completely collapsed. So this was like a second start. And you never know exactly why something worked the second time around. I don't think it was just because we all had T-shirts, which we proudly wore, saying, stop the book famine. But I think that really helped as a way of kind of characterizing what it would feel like to be blind and unable to have access to books. It was a book famine. And that word famine really just captured people's attention. Nevertheless, it did take at least 6 or 7 years. I can't even remember quite how long we went. At first, everyone was kind of just nice about it. And then as the publishing industry began to realize this might actually happen, they began to be very, very oppositional and really oppose almost every aspect, and were able quite often to get other national entities to agree with them. Probably the most negative force against this treaty, and the one that I believe was most susceptible to the publishers, was the European Union. So this is another thing that is very unusual about SCCR, which is that when we are in session, it is possible for someone from Luxembourg to speak, or from France in their national capacity, but really the authority speaking comes from the European Union representatives, who of course are in a way representing no one. They're the bureaucrats who speak for that entire group. And the EU was just not willing to have any part of this until this moment that I will never forget in Marrakesh. We finally met, the negotiations were going on, and the EU was not moving. And I saw the then director general do something that I never saw before or after, which was essentially to call out the EU in the public session and basically say, you are continuing the book famine. If we can't make some progress here after we've gathered and made so much progress and get to the finish line, it's going to be on you. And you can just kind of feel the moment when the publishers and their representatives through the EU understood that they were getting ready to come under a very black cloud, so to speak. So it was really one of those wonderful turning moments right in the middle of that week. And then things fairly quickly came to a close. But it was at least a 20, maybe even a 25-year process. So I try to think about that when I think, well, our first copyright treaty for libraries was only introduced in 2005 or 2006, I think we first began to shop it around. So if you take the long view and compare it to what happened with the blind, we're doing okay. We have to take solace.
So it's interesting because you were pointing out that the only folks that really have a voice at these treaty discussions are official representatives. So how are the publishers then getting their voices heard? Is this through independent meetings? Do they come to the meeting as an observer? How are they involved?
Yes. Well, they're involved in exactly the same way we are. So one thing I will say about the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights is very open to NGOs that want to come. Usually the very first agenda item after adoption of the agenda is the admission of new members. And so we've never had a problem about that. So we're often actually seated side by side with the publishers, not at all unusual, or people from licensing agencies. I'm sorry, it's been so long since I was actually there. But we're all sitting there together, representatives from all the NGOs with our label in front of us. Almost always, member states are invited to speak first, and then if there is time, then we'll be invited to speak. And I will say, I think we've been treated very fairly. When I put my light on saying I want to speak, I'm almost always the first or one of the very first people who's invited to make what we call an intervention.
Okay, so they're talking with the EU. They're also participating in the group discussions. That makes perfect sense. So after Marrakesh, where do you see the SCCR headed? What is the next kind of issue that's on the horizon?
Well, the very biggest issue that's on the horizon and the longest there is a broadcasting treaty. So there are basically right now two major issues before the SCCR. There are a few other that have kind of crept in, like the Russians wanting to have theater stage directors to answer. But the two topics that are given roughly 4 out of the 5 days, more or less evenly divided, are the treaty on broadcasting and then the treaty for libraries, archives, and museums. And that one has been under discussion. It was under discussion the first time I went. It is still under discussion. And you know, glacial progress is made or appears to be made. And then one of the things I need to be maybe clear about, another oddity or a feature of SCCR, is that regime change really matters. So you can be moving along very nicely and suddenly a country's regime changes. This happened to us very explicitly with Brazil. We had two very, very strong supporters from the Brazilian Copyright Office who were working with us very closely, who were advocating for us, but often introduce articles or motions that were in our favor. And one day we were there and they had this panic look came across their faces. We found out the regime had changed. They had been summoned home. And the next people who came from Brazil had really no interest in libraries. So that's a whole other reason that it takes so long to get things done, because you develop relations and then those people vanish. Another problem is that people who are there, usually not from the United States, for example, who really do come from our federal agencies, but most of the people representing countries there are the ambassador of that country to the United Nations in Geneva. And so they don't have any copyright expertise. There may be meetings that are going on across town at one of the other United Nations agencies, so they may have to divide their time. And of course, as is true with diplomats, they usually have a 2 or 3 year post. So it's again a constant re-educating for the people who are actually representing the countries and have the vote. So that's another factor that complicates, well, actually makes speed impossible. So we're in a constant educational mode, which is enjoyable from one point of view, because you are training people. But it's really sad when you see someone who's really been a strong, fervent supporter from one of the countries depart, and you know you may not get a good replacement, and you have to start all over.
It's curious to me that the strong supporter doesn't then talk to their replacement, because it seems to me that the education could be within the organization instead of from the other participants. Does that ever happen, or is that pretty rare?
It does happen, and I can name examples. I won't necessarily here, but there are countries where that has definitely happened. But again, these people are diplomats who aren't invested necessarily in copyright. They may have much more concern about human rights, which is across the street, or international trade, which is down the road. They don't necessarily think that this is even an important enough topic as compared to others that they would really highlight as putting at the top of the list for their successor.
Well, that makes sense, but it also seems like it's unfortunate for those folks who are invested. When you're talking about libraries and archives, are you talking about the ongoing discussions about how we have, for instance, in the United States, you know, exceptions for libraries and archives for preservation? Is that the issue? Because I understand Kenny Cruz wrote a report years ago for WIPO, kind of outlining the world and how different countries have different laws on this topic.
Yeah. Well, I would say There are three major things that have been wonderful for libraries during the time that I have been working at SCCR. The first one I already talked about was Marrakesh, kind of from the beginning, we were able to see the end of that. The second was that we were invited by the WIPO Secretariat in 2003 or four, fairly early on in the time that I became engaged. We told them one of the things that was really, really difficult for all of us is to know actually what were the copyright provisions in all the member states. And WIPO is quite eager and willing to fund these kind of nonpartisan kind of activities. And so they asked us to suggest three or four people who might be able to undertake such a study. We put Kenny at the top of our list. I think at the time he was still at Columbia as the copyright librarian. And he was engaged to undertake this work, which he did. And it was published, and he was invited to come and do a presentation for, I think, a half day and take questions from the member states about it. So it was the very first time I think there was ever one central place where you could go to see, well, how many countries actually have an interlibrary loan partnership. And then, very happily for us too, about a decade later, WIPO asked Kenny if he would update that study, which he did. And it's on the SCCR website. So very, very useful for all of us and providing data that we could actually use both in our oral presentations that we make, but also in our meetings with the various regional groups. So if I could take another kind of a side note, one of the things I didn't mention that's also an interesting factor of how we work as a group at the SCCR, each region has a group. So there's an African group, there's a Latin American, Caribbean group, and so on. There is also what's called Group B, which is really the European Union, Canada, and the United States. So the more developed countries are in a group. And then there's a small subset of the countries of the former Soviet Union. China is its own group. But in any case, what we often do, both before we get to Geneva, but also while we're there, is to arrange meetings with these groups. So quite often at 7 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, we're going in and sitting down with all the representatives from the African countries and talking with them about not only what we want in general, but about what the situation is in those countries. And we've tried with some success to always have a librarian from one of those countries with us, because people really prefer to hear someone from Algeria talking about what Africa needs more than they do about someone from the United States. So that's been a wonderful way of making inroads. But again, all of those groups have a one-year term for the chair. So you may have a year where you've got someone from Algeria who loves libraries. The next year, you may get someone from Togo who has no interest at all and doesn't even want to have the library group come and talk to them necessarily. So that's another thing of this constantly changing wind and interactions with people, because the people change and then the roles change as well. But anyway, the study that was done by Kenny, the two, is I think one of the most useful things that SCCR has done. And that was at our recommendation, but at their expense, and something they're still very, very proud of.
You mentioned, also, there's turnover of the Secretariat General, and you also mentioned how instrumental the Secretariat was in getting the Marrakesh Treaty passed. Does it depend a lot on who that person is?
Yes, it definitely does. And I think what happened with the Marrakesh Treaty is that there is a 10-year term of the Director General, and that person's term was coming toward an end. It's very unusual for that person to be reappointed. So he knew he was going home to Australia. And I think that really made it maybe easier from a practical sense to really press as he did. The good news for us is that we had, as the most, the former chair of the Standing Committee on Copyright, the head of the Copyright Office of Singapore. And when it came time to choose a new Director General, he was chosen out of several different applicants. So we now have at the top level within the World Intellectual Property Organization, someone who is himself a copyright specialist and who has direct experience of having led the SECR for, I think, a five-year term, and has continued to be very, very supportive of us.
And what year is he now in his 10-year term?
I think it may be, well, you know, it's so hard to remember anything during COVID. I think it's the fourth year or maybe the fifth. Something like that. It's maybe 4 years, I think. He also has been very instrumental in helping us get one thing done, the last big thing that I'm really particularly proud of because it is tangible. And that is the preparation of something called the Preservation Toolkit. So during COVID, when meetings weren't being held, but they were still hoping there could be some progress, I did reach out to the Director General, as well as to the Assistant Secretary General who's working in the copyright arena, to see if there wasn't something we could do in the area of preservation, because that seemed to be something that everyone understood was a problem. But not every country really has the authority to do copying, even for preservation purposes. So what eventually happened was that they said, well, why don't we prepare a toolkit? And that term is extremely important because within the odd way in which WIPO worked, a toolkit didn't require the approval of all the member states. It didn't have to be discussed with the member states. It doesn't have to be adopted by the member states. It's a tool that countries may use or not use. And so that's why it was able to proceed. But you know, something's better than nothing, I think, in this environment. And I'm especially happy we did it because of some of the things that have happened in the course of the preparation of it. Things like the war in Ukraine, things like floods, things like fires in the National Library of South Africa and the museum in Rio, have really made it very, very clear that if you don't do some preemptive preservation, it's too late and it needs to be cross-border if it's truly going to be preservation. So the Secretariat did commission representatives from each of our sectors, libraries, archives, and museum, to prepare this toolkit. It has been prepared and it is going to be presented at an on-site meeting in Geneva at the very end of this month. I'm so, so sad I'm not being able to go to this event because it exactly coincides with my retirement dinner. So I really didn't have much of a choice about it. But by the end of September, this will have been released, introduced, and then we, as librarians, our friends of the archives and museum world, can begin promoting it and using it. We hope that we'll at least be able to get preservation provisions in national law, as well as kind of moving, as we hope, toward an international instrument at some point that really deals with the cross-border issues.
That sounds really important work, especially given, as you mentioned, all the disasters we've been having. And we're going to have more with natural disasters and fires and, I mean, you name it, right? Hurricanes.
Yes.
I think climate change is really threatening our collections and our collective memory institutions. So,
yes. And you know, we keep making the point that after the things are gone, they can't be preserved. It seems so obvious, but this need that you don't have to even prove at this point that something is deteriorating, just need to be able to get copies of it somewhere that are safe. And that requires that it be in a different location. And maybe ideally multiple locations, which is a battle we'll have to fight at some point. How many is enough? You know, one thing I didn't really mention at the beginning, and I should have, because it's a really important part of our collaboration. When we first began, it was libraries, and we actually drafted something we called TLIB, Treaty for Libraries. And I was really happy that working with archives and museums over time, that we were able to get them engaged with us as well. So we now have a draft treaty called TLAM, Treaty for Libraries, Archives, and Museum. And the three entities work very, very closely, as we saw with the development of the preservation toolkit, but there was one representative for each of the sectors that were very much involved in preparation of that. So that's a great step forward as well, I think, thinking about how libraries, archives, and museums are much more alike than they are different, and that we we work together, not separately or against one another.
Yeah, and I think your point about the many copies is really important, because it's not only that you've made the copy, which is important, that's a first step, but then if that copy is held on site and the site is destroyed, you still don't have the copy. So the cross-border issue really seems central, and I hope that we're able to make some progress on that too.
I think that it's fairly, well, fairly easy. In SCCR context, it's kind of crazy to say, but I can imagine getting an instrument that provides for the preservation. I think the hardest part is going to be about the access part. And so one of the things we keep saying, you know, there needs to be able to be access. You can't just have something that was copied in, say, in Algeria, and it's being housed in a library in Paris, but can never be opened. And so at some point, there has to be a reasonable trigger event that would enable the preserved work to actually be used. And, you know, there are people who still are arguing that, yes, but when that happens, there needs to be a fee. And, you know, that's a kind of battle that we'll have to fight with the people who want to monetize everything. But at least it's a step in the right direction. And even if we could get each country to have its own preservation provision, that would be a step forward in the right direction, too. I think we forget in the United States how lucky we really are. We're never entirely satisfied, nor will we ever be. But when I think about provisions that we have and compare to a lot of our counterparts, including in the European Union, we actually are much better off than many of them.
I think that's true. And I think it's part of the reason that this work at the international level is so important, is to really show that these provisions are important and that these provisions help libraries, archives, museums, and our patrons, right, to gain access to materials. I think that's something that the United States can really lead on.
Well, we keep just saying our mantra is information is borderless. I mean, this whole idea that goes back to an era when, yes, a book was one place and then it might be the next, you know, it's just not like that now. And I think, you know, again, with the passage of time and seeing how the internet has developed and so on, people know in their hearts that that really is true. They may not want to get that embedded in a way that that is really useful at the national or international level, but there's no denying that we have to be thinking about these, not at national level, but at an international level, because of the way in which information is created and shared and stored today.
Very true. Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I've learned a lot, and I hope the listeners appreciate it too. And congratulations on your well-earned retirement. It sounds like you are going to continue to do wonderful things. I look forward to many, many more years of your engagement with international copyright.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I've really enjoyed. Bye-bye.
Bye.